This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with John Spain, Vice Chairman, Executive Vice President, the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. He's held that post for about 20 years and was news director at WBRZ Channel 2 for a couple of decades. We'll talk with John Spain about some of the endeavors he's been involved with of late and some reflections on his career as a journalist. Optimism is mounting for a Baton Rouge to New Orleans rail line. That's one of John's passions. He's been at the forefront trying to make this happen. And if it does, a $10 to $15 passenger train ride between the two biggest cities in the state could be just a year or so away. We'll talk with John Spain about what's going on in our city beyond that. It's been a tough year for crime, but there are some good things involving development that he is on the forefront about. We'll talk about it. Now the news on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Caroline Menville Olasso producing today, and in studio is John Spain. And if you'd like to join the conversation to hear from the man who's the Executive Vice President of Baton Rouge Area Foundation, and of course was at WBRZ Channel 2 for almost a quarter century, your number is 877-217-5757, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Much ground to cover with John Spain, who has been a fixture in this community for a long time, and he and I were talking a bit about his days at WBRZ as we were leading up to the show, but you knew this city pretty well long before you arrived at WBRZ when you were a very young man.
Yeah, I actually started doing radio back in high school, and part of what we're going to talk about today, I was actually working for WLCS, which was the number one rock radio station in Baton Rouge. I also had news, and I started actually doing news, covered a couple of events while I was still going to LSU, and then ultimately went to WBRZ, where I was a weekend weatherman, and we both agreed I was terrible at that and moved on pretty quickly, but became a reporter, a producer, then a news director, and ultimately station manager in my time there.
1973, you went to work at WBRZ, and you mentioned WLCS. Some of us remember the day when AM ruled the dial, and that was the number one station at 910 on the dial, wasn't it?
It absolutely was, and we used to sign off. Remember, WLCS pays $10 for the best news tip of the week phone into our studios at Dickens 24411, which tells you how old I am.
$10, which was a lot of money.
Which was a lot of money, and people actually called in.
I'm sure they did. That might not be a bad idea now. And Andrea Klesse, one of your proteges, she once said of you, said, John Spain, and I've used this line a time or two, that there are no slow news days, only slow news people.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we ran a pretty tight shop and we're very competitive. The business was competitive. And we always strive to do our best to be number one, be fair-minded, and do what we thought was best. And I was blessed to be surrounded by extraordinarily talented people, both on the air and behind the scenes, that helped us be successful.
877-217-5757. And we're going to talk about his big passion with BRAF, and there are a few, but one of those that's gained a lot of attention of late is the rail line. But before we go there, I think for those who are unfamiliar, back in the day when WBRZ ruled the world in Baton Rouge, you had technology that was as good as any station in the country, you had talent that was as good as any station in the country, and yet you were president of the National Radio and Television News Directors Association. That was high cotton in those days, wasn't it?
It was. It was the International Association of News Directors, and it had thousands of members, obviously, from small and large market, as well as network news people at it. And I was privileged to lead that organization for a year, and it was a very exciting time.
A listener has noted... This is Holly in the Garden District asking about the dearth now of full-time investigative reporters. We don't have many of those today, but back in your day, you had John Camp winning all these national awards, Peabody Awards, one of the most prestigious honors in journalism.
Yeah.
Why do we not have local stations doing more investigative work and having reporters assigned only for that. Is it money?
It's money, and both of the local stations would tell you that they are doing investigative reporting. It's just how you define it. When I hired John Camp, I told him he wasn't required to do a story a week or a story a month. He only was required to do a story when it was ready. And often that was one a year, and it was very time-consuming. Generally, we got sued, which cost us a lot of money to defend those things. But as you pointed out, we won two Peabody Awards, which are the Pulitzer Prize for Broadcasting, and for a market this size, that was really extraordinary. We also got lucky. You know, one of them was for Jimmy Swaggart. And I said, you know, somebody was going to do the story, and Camp did, won a Peabody for it. The other one was for a story on what was then the American Bank, and there were some insider loans being made without security, and we called it Keys to the Vault, and won a Peabody for that one. It was the largest advertiser on the TV station. Some of our owners had actually been on the board of directors of the bank, so it was very controversial, but they said, do with it what you find, and you report on it, and they let us do it, and it ended up being a great piece of journalism. But in those days, Camp had his own producer. He had his own film team, and he generally did about one story a year, but they were pretty phenomenal. They ran in prime time, and it took a lot of commitment and cost for us to do that, and I think it's just hard to justify that today.
Did American Bank pull its advertising?
It absolutely did.
So it cost the station some money.
It absolutely did.
And then you mentioned litigation, which is expensive. And, for example, our company, we carry insurance for that. But still, it can be a costly endeavor. And you sometimes have to settle these matters for an amount. And it happened, I know, at your chief competitor. They were sued by the lieutenant governor. And
Elected officials always want to file a lawsuit just to have the public understand that they think they're innocent. The allegations made in the report are wrong. We never lost a case, and we never paid a dime to anybody for them. And that was a tribute to John and a process we put together so that our lawyers were involved from the first writing of the scripts.
All right. And another listener notes that you were out front on the Barry Seal story, which, of course, had layers and layers that ultimately ended in his death in 1986. That was an amazing story.
It's a very surprising story. His brother was actually the TV station's helicopter pilot at the time, and I'd known the Seal brothers for many, many years. And the federal government had turned Barry, and he was a federal witness. And he found himself getting caught between a deal he had made with the feds and the state police who still wanted to charge him. And he came to us and said, I need to tell you my story. And Barry had actually penetrated the Medellin cartel and had dinner with Ochoa and all these big drug dealers in Colombia. And the federal government had, he told me a couple of stories. He said, I'm going to take you to Mena, Arkansas. I'm going to show you a big military airplane that I was given by the federal government to import drugs as part of a sting operation. And I doubted that story. And we went to Mena, Arkansas. And there was this massive military cargo plane with no markings on it. And it had identifiers that it could tell the DEA that I'm a friendly airplane flying in. And he became an agent for the federal government trying to fight the war on drugs. And ultimately, as you said, the Medellin cartel put a contract out on him, and he was killed in Baton Rouge. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, the Salvation Army halfway house, airline highway.
Exactly right.
And he took a lot of secrets to his grave. But Channel 2, WBRZ, was reporting some of that and was in the front on that story, as it was on many others. And another listener notes the 1984 shooting at the airport. Abe McGull was your photographer, and Ed Buggs was the reporter, and an unusual turn of events. You obviously had some idea that this gentleman, Mr. Doucette, was being returned. And unfortunately for him, Mr. Ploche, the fellow he had wronged, was at the airport with a gun. What happened?
We did have a source that told us they were bringing him back, and Mike Barnett with EBR Sheriff's Office were escorting him through the airport, and there was a bank of public telephones on the wall. And as they walked by, the shooter turned and fired a shot that killed him instantly. Abe McGull, as you pointed out, was the photographer and was actually in the line of fire. He's lucky that the bullet didn't get him as well. It was probably one of those rare moments, and there have been a few, but where television cameras actually covered the entire thing. There was no question who did it. There was no question that in fact, was the thing. I was at a black tie dinner, and I got called on the radio, and we said, send it to the TV station, and I went to the TV station to look at it and said, we can't show all of this. And we decided that we were going to show, you know, a good part of it, but not some of it. And as far as I know, we never did air the thing in its entirety, but it did get picked up and has been replayed literally thousands of times.
Not in its entirety, though.
Not in its entirety.
But it is a gruesome...
It is, and it's probably on the Internet plenty of places
well,
today.
Yeah, but that was March of 1984, Friday night. I remember you were off the air, though. It was after the newscast, wasn't it?
Actually made the 10 o'clock news.
It did make the 10 o'clock news?
And just barely. There was an argument to be made that we're not going to show somebody being killed on TV.
Well, we'll pick up with that and more from John Spain after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're continuing our discussion with John Spain, Vice Chairman, Executive Vice President, Baton Rouge Area Foundation. And a few listeners have noted that there have been some changes there, which we also will discuss. We do want to remind you we're nearing the end of the year and we've got some goals to meet at WRKF, and we would like to hear from you. And if you're so inclined, if you haven't contributed this year, this is a great opportunity. By donating to WRKF today, you will show your support also for music education through Kids Orchestra, a donation of $100 or more, and you can choose to provide music supplies to the Kids Orchestra as your thank you gift. Please give us a call. 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. You can always go to WRKF.org, and we thank Kelly Hurtado, who has called in the last few minutes, who, of course, is involved with the Kids Orchestra. Kelly, of course, is a longtime person in the business herself, and we thank her for her contributions to the station and to our community. John Spain is here, and if you'd like to join us, 877-217-5757. I've gotten more than a few emails at talk@talklouisiana.org, and we were talking about some of the searing stories that he was involved with when he was news director at Channel 2, and one of those was a murder at the airport involving Gary Ploche, who shot with Roland Doucette. That was this gentleman who had kidnapped Ploche's son, and when he was returned to Baton Rouge, Ploche was waiting for him, and it very reminiscent of Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. If it had happened at 10 o'clock, would it have been live?
No. I think it would have been delayed in any case.
You were not going live to the airport.
Well, we beamed it back from the airport so we could make the 10 o'clock, and then I was at the station with a number of other people, and we looked at the raw footage and said, we can't show all of this. And there was some in the audience that said we shouldn't air any of it. And I made the decision that, no, this was a major news story. We were going to do it, but we were not going to show all the gore and all of that. We just were going to show the shooting itself, and we did. And it was very controversial. I don't know that there have been other examples where you actually captured all of that on film. But it went nationwide very quickly, and as far as I know, we've never shown the entire part of it. But Abe McGull, as I said earlier, was lucky that he didn't get shot at the time, and I give him the credit for standing, you know, very still, and despite a gun going off literally feet away from him, he followed all of the action.
He stayed with the shot, literally.
He did.
But the gun at one point, when you slow it down, pointed right at him, right?
It absolutely was the case, yes.
And he hung in there. and a good man and a fascinating fellow. He's been on this show, but it'd be good to have him back sometime soon. But another listener notes, and this is something we'll talk about in a few days. We're coming up in a few days, 50 years since the North Boulevard uprising. And you were a young reporter. You were WLCS then, weren't you?
I was. And I was on North Boulevard when all of that happened. And as your listeners will remember, it's 1972. A group of Muslims from both Illinois and California had come to Baton Rouge and in their language said, we've come to basically give the city back to the black citizens of this city. And tensions had been very tough for two or three days, and ultimately they blocked off North Boulevard right in front of the Lincoln Theater. And that, of course, called the police and sheriff's deputies to the scene. And ultimately, two deputies were killed, and two of the out-of-town members of the Muslim group were killed as well, and 31 other people, I think, were actually wounded. Channel 2, where I went to work 1 year later, had Henry Batiste, Al Crouch, and Bob Johnson. And, of course, Bob was permanently injured in that from brain damage on that day. When we were standing there looking at all of this, when the shots fired, I ducked and got under a car, and several other people were joining me under that car to kind of get out of the way. And it was a very ugly time. National Guard was called in. Woody Dumas was the mayor. And ultimately, many of those people were tried in court. Despite many pleas for a change in venue, they were not given them. And ultimately, those cases were reversed down the road in 1973.
Now, we've got some folks who obviously have been in this community a long time, and another listener, and I guess they're right, said you also broke the story when Pat Screen, the mayor, had his substance abuse problems. And as it turned out, those problems were far more serious than were discussed at first blush. Were you in any way trying to protect the community, maybe even protect him? Did you hold back on anything at that time about the revelations regarding Mayor Screen?
No. I was very close to Pat and knew him well. And we had been following that story. And in fact, I think we were the very first ones to know that Pat had died. And I had to call his wife and tell her that before we aired the story. We weren't going to air it without her knowing. And I had to make that call, and I called Kathy and said, you know, I apologize, and this isn't the way this should happen, but I need to tell you about a story we're going to put on the air. And Pat's gone. And it was a tough day, as you can imagine, for his family, but we put it out there.
And his family is remarkable. And he was remarkable, but he had demons.
He did, and he could have, you know, he could have been the president of the United States. He was smart, and he was just brilliant in many ways and had a wonderful personality, loved life. I liked him a great deal. I thought he did a really nice job for us. He was an innovative, different kind of mayor, and it was just a tragedy that it turned out the way it did.
September 12, 1994, I remember that. He was 51 years old, and by political standards today, put it in perspective, Pat Screen's a younger man than Joe Biden, and that would be if Screen were alive today. He was a young man on the way to great things, mayor when he was 37 years old, but he had issues that he could not get under control. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with John Spain. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Yes, Mr. Spain, recently on this program, Michael Marsh blamed the higher-ups at WBRZ for burying the Dean Vicknair story detrimental to an Indian colleague of Bobby Jindal. Were you one of those higher-ups?
No, I was not at the TV station at the time.
That was long after John left. But did you ever kill stories?
Not that I remember.
If they were grounded. I'm sure you killed them probably because they weren't totally locked down. But
we talked about the American Bank story, our number one advertiser back then. And I remember sitting down with Doug Manship and him looking at it and He was just really upset because these were his friends, and this was a big bank and a big advertiser, as we said. And his first comment was, I'm not going to let you air it. And I thought, wow, we're in trouble. And he said, and I'll tell you why. And Doug knew more about what was going on in some areas. And he sent us back and said, go back and look at this, 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 and this. And call me when it's done. We went back and re-edited, found out that he actually was correct. And there were some things that we hadn't really chased down. We re-edited it, changed the story, came back, showed it to Doug. And he said, it's going to cost me a lot of money, but you can run it. And we did. And after that, we pretty much knew that if we did it right, the owners of the TV station were going to support us, and they always did.
Another listener notes, we lost actually three political giants statewide, May, June, July, Buddy Romer, Jimmy Fitzmaurice, and Edwin Edwards. Now, you and Edwin had a relationship that was up and down, didn't you?
It was a love and hate relationship, and the newspaper was very tough on Edwin. And as a result, he didn't particularly care for the TV station either. And I called him one day and I said, Governor, I'd like for you to come do the morning show. And I thought Edwin was going to tell me no. And he said, John, I'm going to tell you something. He said, you've got the most powerful television station in Baton Rouge. He says, anytime I get a chance, I'm going to come be on that TV station so I can talk to my people, tell them my side of the story. I'm always going to take advantage of that. And he did. And as far as I know, he always came when we asked him to, and he used it with his talent to tell his side of the story.
877-217-5757. We'll be back, and we'll talk about the rail line between Baton Rouge and New Orleans after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And a reminder also that we'd like to hear from you. It's the end of the year. We're trying to meet our goals at WRKF, and your support is vital, and we appreciate it. I know it's been coming fast and furious for almost 42 years, so let's keep a good thing going. And if you'd like to contribute today, a donation of $100 or more will provide music supplies to the kids' orchestra as your thank you gift. 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. John Spain in the house, Vice Chair, Executive Vice President, Baton Rouge Area Foundation. In his years at the foundation, he's been involved in tax credits for inner city rebuilding, and his projects include the passenger rail linking Baton Rouge and New Orleans, as well as master plans for the medical district in Baton Rouge and the lakes at LSU. But much conjecture about the rail line, presumably coming soon. How close are we?
Pretty close. All the pieces are in place. The rail line that we want to use is currently owned by Kansas City Southern, but it's about to be sold, we think, in the next 12 months to Canadian Pacific. And while KCS was never in favor of having passenger trains on their track, Canadian Pacific is actually Amtrak's best-performing freight operator that allows passenger service on their lines. So they have a lot of experience with them, and Amtrak has added the Baton Rouge-New Orleans line to their strategic long-term plan. So we have Amtrak on board. We now have the next owner of the line saying they will let it happen. And the infrastructure bill that was passed recently by Congress has $66 billion that can be applied for infrastructure improvements, which we will need to improve the speed on this train. We have the support of the president, the governor, both mayors, the parish presidents, and we have polling that shows the people that live in both cities and all of the cities in between are overwhelmingly in favor of it. So it is a competitive process to draw the money down, and that will probably start, you know, sometime mid-2022. And as your listeners know, Mitch Landrieu was recently appointed by the president to oversee that project. He will obviously be fair and transparent, but we have the hope that he understands this project and will consider it for funding. So all the pieces are there. Canadian Pacific said, as far as they were concerned, once they own it, we could run it tomorrow. But they won't own it until the Surface Transportation Board approves the sale from Kansas City Southern, which is expected to be the end of next year. But that'll give us time to apply for the money, start doing some of the infrastructure, and we think it's as close as it's ever been.
Again, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And here's a question from Ebony about who benefits more. Have you, now, I think more people go from Baton Rouge to New Orleans than the other way around. Is it a good bet that both communities will benefit equally, or perhaps will New Orleans benefit more than us?
There's about 1,000 people that live in one city and work in the other every day, and that's a very, very conservative number. There's also a study that was done by the Baton Rouge Airport a number of years ago that said roughly 50% of the people who now fly in the capital area use Louis Armstrong. And so we know there are a lot of people driving to go down to the international airport. Baton Rouge Airport has great service. We all are pleased to have that airport. But in some cases, direct flights are less expensive from New Orleans, so a lot of people for personal flights
go to New Orleans. So this would go to the airport?
It would be a stop at the airport, and ultimately I think what the airport wants to do is have a light rail, a monorail, if you will, that you would get off of this train that would take you into the brand-new terminal in New Orleans. We also tend to think of this as Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but there'll be stops in Gonzales, stops in Laplace, and a lot of those people will be the people who are riding it into the city. And so if you think about the number of cars we might take off of I-10, which is generally congested, say there are 1,000 people in each city, and say half of them ride a train. You're taking that many cars off the highway, which should help the congestion. It's clearly going to be a benefit to the environment. And it won't be for everybody, but it gives you an alternative. And what we say about the train is it's predictable. It's not going to be involved in a traffic jam. It's not going to be involved if there's a wreck or a truck turns over. You will know when you get on it, you know, that you're going to arrive at the other end in a set amount of time. It's also going to allow you to be productive while you're riding. I ride a lot of trains, and I was riding a train in Florida, and I asked a lady who was working on a laptop across from me going from West Palm to Miami. And I said, can you tell me why you ride the train? And she says, I'm a lawyer. I'm going to see a client in Miami. And she smiled and said, I can actually bill clients for the 2 hours of train going and coming. It's a very productive day. I could drive, but it would be unpredictable. And I couldn't bill because I couldn't be productive. I think a lot of that can happen on this route. People will just find that's a better use of their time than driving.
How long will it take to go from?
About 1 hour and 20 minutes. And people say, well, I can do that on my car. My experience, and I think a lot of people would agree, is that we all kind of tell ourselves it's about 1 hour, 1 hour, 15 minutes. But generally when you're leaving Baton Rouge to go to New Orleans, somewhere around the New Orleans airport exit, there could be another 45 minutes to an hour getting downtown on certain days when there's traffic. And the same thing happens on occasion when you're coming back here. And again, it's an alternative, and it's been in the making for a long, long time. And we used to have this service. It just hasn't run in 20 years.
So if we stop at the airport, I presume we're also going to stop in downtown New Orleans. We're stopping downtown Baton Rouge. How many other stops along the way?
You go to Baton Rouge, Gonzales, Laplace, Louis Armstrong, and the Union Pacific Terminal in downtown New Orleans, which is about a block from the Superdome. And so people could go instead
see
of parking, see a game, go to an event. And I had someone when I did a radio interview yesterday in New Orleans, they all were talking about we could go from LSU games from New Orleans, and they could. And so I think special events like that, you know, people will find very comfortable. If you're going to have a drink or glass of wine or something, you don't want to drive, take the train.
Doug on I-10. Doug, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with John Spain. Hi, Doug.
Yes, good morning. This is a tremendous opportunity, and I think, as Mr. Spain's been pointing out, we're probably underestimating the number of folks from New Orleans who would use the service if it were available, and other folks, too, who haven't even thought about it, you know, but if they have that option, they will. One concern I've raised is, you know, the terms are somewhat fluid, but in America, we need passenger rail. We don't need high-speed rail in most places. A good standard passenger rail system will be perfectly fine, and the benefits in safety and comfort, as well as, you know, comparable time is fine, but we don't need the most advanced, because those are the most expensive systems, you know, the really advanced high-speed rail, and it's not really necessary here, I don't think.
I agree, and high-speed has its place. Because there are so many stops that we've talked about, you have no reason to get up to 100, 150 miles per hour when you're going to stop at another stop in another 10 or 15 minutes. This train will run somewhere between probably close to 90 miles an hour. between 80 and 90 miles an hour, and that's fast enough on a what is a 90-mile run with three or four stops, and each stop will last about 3 or 4 minutes. People get on and off, and it just keeps going, but this will not be true high speed.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with John Spain. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Spain. When I was a kid, my dad put us on the passenger train called the Spirit of New Orleans. My sister and I came down on that train, and at that point in time in the 60s, there was a whole nexus of transportation options. There was a Greyhound bus, there was the train station, and then there was the city government and then the library. That whole area down there was an incredible, it was safe, there was a lot going on, and it's something that the city needs to do again. I just think it's a great idea, and thanks.
Thank you. I think the other thing I would point out is while we're focused on the New Orleans Baton Rouge train, the same track goes all the way to Shreveport. And the state has tried without success to connect North and South Louisiana through regional airlines and things. And so when we get Baton Rouge, New Orleans up and running, we do want to look at connecting Baton Rouge to Shreveport and then passenger service across the I-20 corridor in North Louisiana.
So it would go from one end of the state to the other potentially?
It could, absolutely.
Well, if we're going to grow as a state, we've got to be innovative.
We have to be connected. And remember, you can be productive. And if it's a 3 or 4 hour ride from Shreveport to Baton Rouge, think about what you could actually get done on a train.
877-217-5757. Mike, good morning. Where are you calling from, Mike?
Hi, Jim. Mike Palmentier calling from
All right, you're fading a bit on us now, Mike. Let's see if we can get you to a better spot. Mike, let's give it another shot. Good morning again. Hi,
hey.
Mike. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Can you hear me?
Better, yes.
I just wanted to thank John Spain for the hard work he's doing we've been excited about it for a decade, but I think John's going to get it done. And I wanted to remind you guys about the court systems and the benefits you may have already talked about, but the benefits of the lawyers coming from New Orleans and lawyers going from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, it'll just be a real benefit to them. So add that to your list of reasons why this is such a great idea.
Well, thank you. And the train will have Wi-Fi, and you'll be able to get a cup of coffee and a beignet in the morning or sandwiches or something later in the day. So you have food and beverages, cocktails at some point, I guess, at some time in the afternoon on these trains. So it'll be convenient, and you can get some work done while you're on the train.
877-217-5757. We have another segment. We'll spend the full hour with John Spain, who's very generous with his time today, and we'll talk about the changes at BRAF and some other matters, and we've got some questions from listeners, and we might even take another call or two. Again, 877-217-5757. And talk at talklouisiana.org. And a reminder that we are at the end of the year and WRKF is trying to meet its 2021 goal. And that means we need a bit more support from you. It's been a good year, but let's make it a great year. And we'd like to hear from you. You can go anytime, any moment you wish at WRKF.org and make your contribution or give us a call at 855-893-9753. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Gene in Innisfail Estates, you're on with John Spain. Hi, Gene. Good morning, Gene. There we go. Do we have Gene? Tell you what, Caroline, while you're getting Gene, I'll continue talking with John, and we're discussing the Baton Rouge New Orleans rail line. I do have some inquiries online. And by the way, I do want to thank some people who have called the last few minutes to show their support for WRKF, to Kevin Berry, Al McDuff, to Will Stringer, Derek Williamson. Thank you so much. Here's another question from Lad in New Orleans. People won't take a shuttle bus from downtown Baton Rouge to Tiger Stadium. What makes us think they're going to take a train from Baton Rouge to New Orleans and vice versa? What do you think?
I think you've got to make the case for it. I think part of what happens in Louisiana is we don't have a history of people riding trains. And so I think people are not going to understand what it is until it's there. And I think given enough time, enough marketing, people will take it. And I think when they do, they'll find the advantage of it. But, you know, some people will clearly say it's a waste of time and money, and other people will find that it's actually a really nice alternative to let them get between the two cities and ultimately between the north and south parts of the state. And time will tell, but I'm pretty confident that based on what we've seen in other states, the first 2 or 3 years you have to build the ridership, and after that it pretty much takes care of itself.
Fed's taking care of most of the expense?
Yeah, the infrastructure bill is an 80-20, so the feds will pay most of the infrastructure, and then there's a six-year plan to help subsidize the first 6 years of operations. And I do think that people will ride a train when they wouldn't ride a bus, and I think you're going to find a lot of people find the train to be really a nice alternative.
Gene in Ennis-Walda States, let's give you another shot. Gene, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Gene.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. I wanted to change your direction a little bit this morning and ask Mr. Spain, was Miss Fran his mother?
Thank you for asking. Yes. I tell people, and it happens to be true, that somebody at least once a week still asks me about my mom. We lost her about 12 years ago, but she lived to be 95. And for those of you that don't know, she was kind of a humorous, a motivational speaker, and was very funny and a joy in my life for many, many years. And I'm so honored and pleased that people still ask me about her. And thank you for that nice question.
Thank you, Gene. And I'm sure you attribute your success to her.
Absolutely.
No doubt. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, good morning.
Good morning, and really good show. And I wanted to call. I've taken the Crescent from New Orleans to New York a lot in the past, and on that train they had a piano, and I would suggest put a piano on the train, because they had guys and women getting up. One guy I'll never forget done Frank Sinatra for about 2 hours. It was really great.
Thank you for sharing that. I don't know that I can get a piano put on, but it's a wonderful idea.
Now, John Davies, who's been at BRAF even longer than John Spain, has left, and he has a successor who's been named, Chris Meyer, who's been on the show a few times, young man, 39, exceptional young man, who now has the keys to the kingdom. And John, BRAF grew from this relatively small entity to a major juggernaut. I don't know of a bigger entity in either of the big cities as far as the kind of things you do. Do you see it going bigger and even more pronounced than it is now?
I do. The growth is John Davies' legacy. When he came 30-plus years ago, the foundation was created by a handful of Baton Rouge people.
Had about $50 million in assets,
yes.
Right?
Actually, about five when he started.
Five? And what is it now?
It's about $700 million. And so this year we will give away, I think, $43 million, making us the largest philanthropy in this part of the country, frankly. I am going to work for another 3 or 4 years, because what I've done, and I tell people, why didn't I want to be president? I said, I never wanted to be president because I got the best job in the foundation. I get to work on projects, and I'm good at it, and I have a team of people that work with me on that, and they're very good at it, and I like what we're doing. Chris Meyer is a really good choice. He has been, as you pointed out, CEO of New Schools for Baton Rouge, which was created by BRAF 10 years ago to bring the best charter schools in the nation to our city, and he's been wonderfully successful. He's raised over $90 million to support that effort. And we are delighted that the board has chosen him from a large group of applicants, and he will actually take mm-hmm. the reins on February 1st. I'm very excited to be a partner with him for a few more years.
We wish him well and look forward to visiting with him in his new capacity. Another listener, this is Tracy at the Capitol, notes the number of downtown hotels. And when I worked downtown in the 80s and 90s, there was nothing. I mean, nothing. And now you've got, the Hampton, the Hilton, the Indigo, the Watermark, the Belle of Baton Rouge, one of the small Marriotts, right? Mm-hmm. That's at least six, and they have all benefited from BRAF, haven't they?
It was a plan called Plan Baton Rouge with a lot of people. Our good friend Davis Rohr was our partner in that for many years. And it was aimed at revitalizing downtown. The Hilton Hotel had been empty and was about to be torn down. And the foundation bought it and put about $70 million into it. We never wanted to be in the hotel business, but we knew that that was going to be something that had to be done if we were going to rebuild downtown. So we kept it for a few years and then sold it. But it's been a remarkable turnaround. There's a lot more work to be done, and they are looking for a successor for Davis's position, and we hope that we will continue partnering with the DDD and make some additional things happen down there.
That was a big loss.
Absolutely. Good friend, good partner.
Now, another listener asks if you had something to do with this gentrification of the area across the street from your old employer, Channel 2. There are a lot of things going on north of the LSU campus that are impressive. Now, we hear about the bottom, but if you go by Channel 2 now, it's a pretty nice look. And it used to be, as we know, it looked like Beirut. What happened there?
We actually did a study probably 10 or 15 years ago for a master plan for the revitalization of Old South Baton Rouge and laid out a plan. We weren't directly involved. Those were all private investments that came in, but we did create the blueprint, and we're very pleased to see that they're actually implementing part of the things we recommended.
Very good. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with John Spain. Hi, Randy.
Yes, I think it's going to be a wonderful thing having the train from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, and it'll be so much nicer for so many people. It'll be fantastic. Thanks.
All right. Well, Randy, I'm sure John appreciates your endorsement. And another listener notes we can't get through the hour without talking about John Madden with a TV guy. And for those of us of our generation, John Madden was around as a coach and then as a commentator for almost a half century. And what a character. And sometimes characters work on television. You had one in Andy Leopold many years ago. And he may not have been as good as John Madden, but he was a character. I enjoyed watching him, and you got to get people to stay where they are when they hit your station, and Madden was exceptional. He was a guy who seemed to enjoy being on the air.
He was the best at what he did, and, Howard Cosell was the other one that came to mind, and a character that just captured early on in the TV business not only how you cover sports, but a unique personality added to it. Leopold was that way. Pat Shingleton was obviously a personality, a dear friend, and could tell you the weather, but could tell you the weather in a humorous way in many times.
Leopold, he did some crazy things back in the day. I think we talked about it years ago. He even boxed a woman once and almost got beat, didn't he?
I think we had to stop it because I think the woman would have beat him to death. we did that.
But that was a gimmick, and I'm sure it got people buzzing. He had Andy's mailbag. I remember that, too.
Exactly.
That was back in the day when people actually wrote letters.
They did. And somebody challenged him because he could make people mad. And this young lady was, challenged him to get in a ring with. And he was silly enough to do it and realized that he was in over his head very quickly. And after a couple of real quick rounds, we stopped it.
Well, he went off. Ultimately, to Los Angeles. Do you know what happened to
him? I talk to him every once in a while. He's out of the business, retired, but he did very well.
And he was good on radio as well. And you had some others who were just remarkable talents. Some who've stayed a long time. And just because a guy like Mahaffey stays forever doesn't mean he is not as talented as Jay Young or Ed Buggs. But you had some people, and as we know, it was kind of like Pat Screen in the case of Ed and Jay. They both had issues that tormented them and ultimately enveloped their careers.
It did. And we worked with them and their families to try to get through those and had some success. But we lost some very, good people. And they were dear friends and very talented people. And I was always privileged to have worked with all of them.
How did you hire people?
I looked at their resumes, and then I looked at their tapes, and then I sat down with them and I talked to them about what they wanted out of their lives, what they wanted out of this TV station, and what they thought broadcast journalism was all about. And it wasn't just about being on TV. I can hire a lot of pretty faces, but you've got to be able to know something about the business, be able to write and tell a story.
writing is an underestimated factor.
And yet it's key.
It is the most key.
Yeah, absolutely true, and people tend to forget that when they talk about TV news.
Well, thank you, John Spain. Keep going, and let's talk again soon. It's been too long, but appreciate what you do for our community, and I respect your long and successful career in journalism.
Thank you for having me, as always. I enjoyed the conversation.
First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support.